Okay, did that work? Okay, it's on. Does that help? That's all I was shown, so I don't know. I'll try and shout. Does that? It's not. You can hear now? Yeah? Yeah? Okay. So sorry about that. Anyway, what I was, hopefully some of you heard, the dilemma of the organism is that it is actually quite predictable in its development of drug resistance. The unpredictability and why we have drug-resistant tuberculosis, of course, is human nature. And that's not surprising with most organisms, but especially so in TB. So tuberculosis, I'm not sure the background of everybody, but I'm sure you're all aware, it's very much a global problem, and it's something that we've been tackling for decades, particularly in resource-poor settings, as you can see here on this map. But Canada, and especially Ontario and Toronto, being very cosmopolitan, heterogeneous population, really the global problem is also our problem. And so just a little bit of TB by the numbers. One-third of the world's population is infected by tuberculosis. By infected, I mean they've had exposure, the tuberculosis organism is in their body. It doesn't necessarily mean they have disease, and it also doesn't mean they will go on to develop disease. However, eventually 5 to 10% will. And almost 2 million persons will die of tuberculosis annually, and this translates into about 5,000 persons every day. And it's estimated that each case that is left untreated that goes on to death will infect an average of 10 to 15 people annually. And of course, some of those will eventually go on to develop active disease. So if you look at the WHO Global Tuberculosis Surveillance, this is their latest map. What it shows you is that most of the TB cases, this is the incident rate, we see in sub-Saharan Africa, but there also is a fair number of cases occurring in the former Soviet Union and its republics, South Asia and Southeast Asia. In Canada, unfortunately I don't have a map of the most recent data, although you can always get that online from the website. What we see here is that the tuberculosis incident rate is actually in 2008 4.8 per 100,000, so it's leveled off slightly, but the highest number of cases, unfortunately for us, is in our north, in Nunavut and the north, Northwest Territories. We also see a much higher incident rate in Saskatchewan that's reflected again in our Aboriginal communities and then in the other more populated provinces. What are we, how are we seeing tuberculosis? What percentages are we seeing by origin? Although that map showed you that in the northern areas, territories of Canada and in Saskatchewan, we have a fair number of Aboriginal cases. In actual fact, most of our cases are foreign-born. Ontario has the largest population in Canada, and the largest percentage of our cases is foreign-born. So really, we do have to pay attention to what's happening globally. That's not to say we should be ignoring what's happening in our Aboriginal populations, because that is unfortunate. But what you do see is also that the Canadian-born non-Aboriginal cases is gradually going down. Tuberculosis through the history spares no one. Just a couple of pictures of two very famous people who were affected by tuberculosis and died from it. John Keats, unfortunately, cut him off very early in his life, and also George Orwell. This is a graph of death rates for tuberculosis per million per annum from the mid-19th century onward. What happened with tuberculosis, it was an epidemic that actually peaked in the mid-19th century and has been declining really ever since, and declining not just because of improvements in public health, improvements in nutrition. In fact, it hasn't really been pinpointed because this decline occurred before some of those things were in place, and they really weren't able to figure it out. So many people sort of thought perhaps it was because they were removing infectious patients from the milieu and into sanatoria, so they were away from infecting other people. It was never totally worked out, but the decline has been occurring ever since then, with a couple of plateaus, which I'll discuss just briefly later. If you look at Canada, from early 1980s onward, this is the decline in cases and the rate that we've been seeing. What I was talking about just a moment ago was this plateau and slight increase that we saw in the mid early 1980s to sort of mid-1990s. And what happened there, and you may recall, the massive outbreak that occurred in New York State, and in fact actually also circulated drug-resistant tuberculosis. And the new director of CDC, Dr. Thomas Frieden, was actually involved in that investigation of that outbreak. And what had happened is the decline in TB continued. In the 1970s, it was thought, well, this disease is just going to go away. We've taken care of it, not an issue. And so funding to public health programs dropped significantly. And then also what happened in the early 80s is HIV appeared. And it is a very prominent risk factor for the development of disease due to tuberculosis. So cases actually went up slightly until more money was pumped in. It was recognized that we needed to improve our diagnosis, to improve our treatment of cases, and we gradually started to bring the rate down again. That took several years and a lot of money. So the pathogenesis of tuberculosis, I have to understand that this organism is transmitted by airborne routes. So it's quite highly infectious, and in fact it's thought that one organism can cause an infection. And again, remember, when I say infection, it means it gets into the body. It is not necessarily going to cause disease. That is entirely dependent on your host defenses. It may be dependent on also your organism burden. If you're only infected by a couple of organisms, that may be it for you for life. And so it depends on the host immunity, cell-mediated immunity, but if it does get in and it can hang around in the air in what are called droplet nuclei for prolonged periods of time, can get sucked up into the ventilation, can be transmitted or across the vents into other rooms, into other areas, so it can actually spread quite far from an infected person. And an infected person, all they need to do is cough, they can talk by singing. Any of these actions can actually transmit organisms through little droplets of sputa that are infected with the organisms. They dry and just sort of hang there in the air, and you may have about 1 to 5 organisms that are present in these droplets, and these droplets are the exact size that are needed to get down into the lower lungs, which is where the organism then sets up housekeeping, if you will, if it can. And what it does is if once cell-mediated immunity gets a hold of the organism, it may just keep it at bay and just keep it hanging there. It may actually set up a reaction, which is a true infection, in which case you'll have this sort of complex present in the lungs, and sometimes this calcifies, and you can see it on x-ray, so you know somebody may have been exposed to TB. They have what's called a small calcified granuloma on x-ray, and that may be it. If the host is unable to contain the infection, it may go on to start replicating and replicating rapidly, and it does so in high oxygen tension areas, and that's such as the lung. It can locally spread through the lymphatic system. It will also potentially hematogenously spread, that is, there may be some intermittent bloodstream infection, and the organisms like to settle in areas of a high oxygen tension, so in the areas of the renal, the kidneys, adrenal glands, can settle along the meninges, so it can actually spread throughout the body and the long shafts of the bones. So TB can infect any organism. It's not just lung, although that's most common, but it can cause infection and disease in the lymphatic system. You may get TB meningitis. You can get renal tuberculosis, bone tuberculosis, and in history, actually, when they look at the Egyptian mummies, it's evident that they had TB by the collapse of the vertebrae, which is a very characteristic picture for what they call Pott's disease, so that's bones infected by TB. So you can just go on, you can have the spectrum of just having the organism there, it just never replicates, it just disappears, to being contained by the host cell-mediated immunity, to then the development of disease. And what the TB organisms do is they form cavities. You get large replicating numbers of these bacilli, and they have these large cavities. They're within there, it's a necrotic debris, and they're called, they're actually called cavitary lesions, and you can see them nicely when you look at chest x-rays, as little circular sort of areas, often in the apical areas of the lung. So that's just a little brief pathogenesis of TB. So what is it about the biology of the organism that makes it sort of different, and also makes it difficult, for example, for us to be able to treat it effectively? Well, if you see this, this is just a picture of TB organisms growing on solid media. They have a sort of buff to tan color. It's got this almost pearly appearance, And that's because it's really the cell wall is what helps TB evade a lot of therapy and why for a long time they could not, most of the antibiotics that had been developed at the time, the sulfonamides, the penicillins, just couldn't deal with it. It's a very, very waxy, thick lipid outer cell wall. So it has this sort of waxiness, and it does take a very long time to grow. So as opposed to some of the other organisms like E. coli, which you can get in urinary tract infections, or Streptococcus pneumoniae, which can cause you pneumonia, they rapidly replicate about every 20 minutes. So if you think about it, if you're going to get a drug that would target the growth of the organism, you have to use this drug for a much longer period of time because it takes so long for it to grow. This is just a picture of what TB looks like in a liquid culture, and because of this waxy nature of it, it likes to kind of stick to itself, and it forms what we call serpentine cording. So this is a whole bunch of the organisms taken out of a liquid broth culture, and this is almost pathognomonic for TB when we look at it under the microscope. This is a special stain that we use called ZN staining. And so the other thing with TB, as I indicated earlier, it can kind of hang there in your body. It can hang there in the lungs, just being dormant. Is it truly not metabolizing? These are things that aren't totally known, but it's still alive. They're just there. And so it's very difficult to target organisms that actually aren't replicating or aren't very active metabolically with drug therapy. And then when it does form disease, you get these large cavitary lesions, which are almost impenetrable. They've got a fibrotic, you know, outer shell to them, so it's hard to get blood flow to them. It's hard to get antibiotics into the lesions. And then you have all this necrotic debris, and inside the lesions, there's very low oxygen tension, and there's also, it's very acidic. So for the development of drug resistance, TB, again, isn't like other bacteria. Why? Well, as I said, it's usually often acquired early in life. It's usually in resource-poor settings. Here, it's a different story. But these organisms enter latency. So metabolically inactive. So if you're going to treat, drugs may just not affect it because it's not actually growing. The other thing is TB organisms, where they're present in, you know, these small granulomas, they're called granulomas, or these contained within these little areas in the lungs, they're not interacting with any other organisms. So they're not exposed to organisms, for example, like Staphylococcus aureus, which may be up in the nares and in your nose and the mucosal surface, but it's hanging out there with a whole pile of other organisms where they can, they're rapidly growing, they can exchange genetic material horizontally, so they can exchange all sorts of means of transferring drug resistance determinants, but TB can't do that. The only way it can develop resistance is through chromosomal mutation, and that's within itself. And the mutation rate for individual genes varies between and within genes, but it's known for prokaryotic cells that there is a recognized spontaneous mutation rate, and that is what makes TB different. It does this, it does it routinely, and it does it in naive populations that have never seen any drugs. So I'm just going to give an example using the three drugs that we use for what's called first-line therapy. I'll get into that a little bit later. But what happens is, in a population, a naive population of TB, you will have the odd organism that just happened to spontaneously mutate in the genes that are responsible for drug resistance to these compounds. So for isoniazid, one of our most potent first-line drugs, they're there, and they're there at a certain rate. If for whatever reason, and this is where the predictable unpredictability of human nature comes in. If a patient decides that they're not going to take all of the drugs that they've been given, and they take their isoniazid, maybe that's all they've decided to take, or they're inappropriately treated, it's not recognized they have disease, and for whatever reason they're only put on isoniazid. My husband, who's a respirologist, has a famous case that he was sent by a physician who didn't know the proper treatment for TB. So he decided to put his patient on a little bit of INH to get him started for 3 months until my husband saw him, which was very unfortunate because, of course, he developed INH resistance. But you can see here that after treating with just effectively one drug, you select out these drug-resistant mutants. And again, within these drug-resistant mutants is the capacity to spontaneously mutate to the other drugs. So you went then eventually, if you treat with rifampin, you will also select out, it's almost as if you have monotherapy again, because you've got your INH-resistant ones. INH is ineffective. You're treating with rifampin. You're going to start selecting out your INH and rifampin-resistant ones. So you get what we, I will describe the definition, but this is what's called multidrug-resistant TB. And this is entirely a man-made phenomenon, unfortunately. So there are two terms that are used for drug resistance in that we see. One is, and I've described how the drug resistance strain comes about. So what I showed you earlier is what's called acquired drug resistance. So you may have a patient who has a fully sensitive isolate. They are inappropriately treated. They may not absorb the drugs. There's other reasons why they develop effectively are being on monotherapy and develop drug resistance. But if they aren't cured, they're still potentially infectious. So when they're in a setting, such as overcrowding, there's inadequate infection control, they can transmit this very drug-resistant organism to others who, depending on their host response, may develop disease, and they are called having primary drug resistance. So you'll see they look at the statistics for drug resistance as those developing on therapy and those that are primary, that is those that are acquired. Or sorry, infected by drug resistance. So this is my only equation here. I had to check it. But it was actually very interesting. And admittedly, I had it wrong initially, so I thought, my God, this is something you guys will pick up very quickly. But here's where you can do the math. This is the predictability of TB drug resistance. It's known that you have these spontaneous mutation rates. It's also known that in each cavity, there's approximately a certain number of organisms. So you can get a sense that, using this equation, you can predict what is the probability of the development of drug resistance. And so where R is the mutation rate. So for example, you may, if you use single drug therapy, as I showed earlier, INH, where you have a risk of mutation of 10 to the minus 6. So say the drug you're using spontaneously mutates, and in any population, this is where you'll have, this is your risk of mutants. The probability in a cavitary lesion is going to be 100%. So you know you are just going to select out a fully drug-resistant population. So what if you treated with two drugs? Well, if you combine them, it's an added at a 10 to the minus 12, if you look at, say, one has a drug-resistant development rate of 10 to the minus 6, the other is another 10 to the minus 6, you actually have 10 to the minus 12. Well, you can overcome that to a certain extent, and you drop the probability significantly. But what if you have a patient who has really bad disease, and we see them, and sometimes you can't treat these patients, unfortunately, sometimes they do die. But they have large cavitary lesions throughout their lungs. They have obviously a very, very large bacterial load. Well, two drug therapy is not going to cut it. So this is why when we initiate therapy in patients, it's usually at least in areas of drug resistance where the rates are known, it's with four drugs. So in the 1970s, looking at naive TB populations, that is, they had not been exposed to any drug therapy whatsoever, the rates of development of drug resistance were worked out here. Streptomycin used to be first-line drug. It's no longer. It's now second-line. But of the three first-line drugs, these are the rates that are known. And it has been determined for some of the other drugs. The simplest drug resistance occurs in rifampin. It's almost 95% of mutations occur in one specific area of the gene. Unfortunately for all the others, it does get more complicated. And I recognize that that equation actually simplifies things greatly. There are many other factors. For example, you may have in one cavity very few organisms. You'll kill them all off. You may have another cavity in the body which is extremely large. And so, of course, it's also dependent on the host. But that sort of gives you a sense that you can somewhat predict the development of drug resistance. The sad thing for TB, and this is maybe some of the darkness at the end of the tunnel, is that we've been using these same drugs for over 50 years. Why is that? Well, number one, it's not a disease that you see too much in the industrialized countries. It is in resource-poor settings, and quite honestly, pharmaceutical companies really don't make a whole lot of money on TB drugs. But if you look at this global problem, which is our problem, we can't ignore it. And the light at the end of the tunnel, I'll get to that in a little bit, is actually that a lot of money has been put into new initiatives for the development of drugs, and there are some very promising therapies coming down the pipes. But the first drug that was developed that was actually found to be effective against TB was streptomycin. everybody was put on streptomycin. It was great. This is fantastic. Very quickly, patients relapsed or they failed therapy. And why was that? Well, monotherapy. And in fact, the early studies done there, they recognized that there were streptomycin-resistant mutants within that the naive populations of TB. So the concept of combination therapy was trialed with other drugs that were developed, PAS being the first one that was combined with streptomycin. And in fact, those early studies showed that the patients on combination therapy did much better. The problem is the activity of these drugs and also the nature of the organism led to the need for very, very prolonged durations of treatment. 24 months, and that was actually the norm way up until the 1970s when rifampin was actually added to the treatment regimen, which was able to greatly shorten them. That's because rifampin is really our wonder drug. It affects all aspects of the TB metabolism, from growth to cell wall building, the metabolism in terms of protein development, replication. It's an extremely important drug. And so that allowed, in combination, streptomycin was actually taken off. That allowed a short course therapy, which was introduced in the 80s, which you can understand would have a much better compliance rate by patients. If a patient has to be on drugs that actually aren't that great to take for 2 years, some people can't even complete a 5-day antibiotic course. How do you get them to complete 2 years? So it was brought down to 6 to 8 months of treatment, which is now standard treatment. But even then, that is still long and still requires, in a lot of cases, patients have to be observed taking their drugs. So what is a first-line drug? Why do we call it a first-line drug? Well, these drugs have to be very bactericidal, have the least toxicity, that's not to say they aren't, as well as act at the early stages where they're rapidly replicating, reducing the bacterial load, as well as being able to act during the slow metabolic phase, which is those organisms that are much more slowly metabolizing, and ones that are also in those lesions that are very hard to get at. And so isoniazid, rifampin, and pyrazinamide are the key drugs for first-line therapy as well. We also add in ethambutol, not quite as effective. It's what's called a bacteriostatic drug. Its activity isn't quite as good at killing as isoniazid, but these four drugs, when used in combination, according to the protocols, generally lead to a cure in about 95%. Nothing's ever 100%, but it's pretty darn good. In a fully susceptible isolate, when they take all the drugs and they're absorbing it. So caveats always. So how is surveillance being performed for drug-resistant tuberculosis? Well, definitions have been put together. Multi-drug resistant tuberculosis has been recognized for quite some time as resistant to isoniazid and rifampin, and those are very key. Those are our two key treating drugs. And then in 2006, extensively drug resistant tuberculosis, or XDR-TB, was recognized. This was recognized in South Africa, where they had very poor capability of treating cases, where you have the HIV co-epidemic occurring, which was leading to disease in a lot of cases. And it's unfortunately not only resistant to isoniazid and rifampin, but also the fluoroquinolones. This is like ciprofloxacin or any of those other drugs that you take. So listed here. And that's unfortunate because this class of drugs is very useful, very effective, and not only that, not that toxic and easy to tolerate, as well as one of the injectable drugs, capremycin, which is a polypeptide drug, and kanamycin, amikacin. Those are our aminoglycosides. So just a little diagram of how these drugs act. So the isoniazid inhibits cell wall synthesis very ably and basically stops the organism in its track. And rifampin inhibits RNA synthesis by binding to the ribosome, so effectively stopping the development of protein replication, etc. Pyrazinamide is sort of unclear where it acts, but the key for it, again, is that it's able to act within these acidic environments within the cavity. So it's actually more active in the core of a caseous cavity than INH and rifampin. They're a little bit more slow. So these in combination work very well. When you lose that, you're left with drugs that do also act in the cell wall, not to the same effect. Bacteriostatic, a little slower. Same for other drugs that may act on DNA replication or protein synthesis, but again, very slow. So what does that mean? Well, it means you're taking drugs that also have a higher toxicity profile and you've got to take them for longer, not very well tolerated, so very difficult to treat. So you really don't want to get to this stage. What happens when you get to XGR? Well, you lose pretty much almost everything. You have a few drugs that you can try, and that's pretty much what the clinicians are faced with. If we have a case of XGR-TB, they throw the book at them. What can the patient tolerate? What seems to be effective? And, of course, the organism, what exactly is it potentially sensitive to? So we do that testing to let the physicians know. So TB, yes, a global problem. What is the WHO seeing in terms of its surveillance for MDR-TB? Well, it looks like here that there aren't many developing in Africa. It's less than 3% for amongst new and retreated cases. That's probably partly because the surveillance is not so great down there. But you can see it's quite ominous in the former Soviet Union republics, China, and also there's development occurring in South Asia. The overall average for the world as of in 2008 was about 4.8% of MDR-TB cases. What are we facing with XDR-TB? Well, almost every nation, including us, has reported cases. I'm sad to say that one of the XDR cases was actually homegrown, and that was because of a case that was very difficult to manage. That's, I think, the way I'm going to put it. So when you have those sorts of patients, the opportunity for them to essentially be on monotherapy for various drugs is very high. We've had, in the world, it's predicted that about 40,000 XDR-TB cases are being produced annually just because of poor therapy, access to drugs, issues with public health. So what are we seeing in Canada? This is a map I have of the latest drug resistance report. Most of the MDR-TB comes from Quebec and Ontario, most of it actually from us. Again, that reflects our large population. It also reflects where do our cases come from. And for the first time ever in Saskatchewan. Now remember, most of Saskatchewan's cases are in their Aboriginal population, so I'm not sure where the origin of the MDR-TB case, but hopefully it wasn't a homegrown one. Interestingly, though, the worry is that is MDR-TB increasing? It doesn't seem to me, but it's there. It does transmit. There's many studies showing that these organisms are less fit, so they don't survive well enough to transmit, but there's also a couple studies showing that they're actually more fit. So there's lots of controversy there, lots of interesting research going on there. But if you look at the MDR-TB rate here, it never really varies between 1.5 to 2%. The bulk of them, again, being contributed by Ontario, and we average, hasn't really changed in the last decade. We average about 10 to 15 MDRs that we identify a year. And XDR cases in total for Canada, we've had 4, 3 of them from Ontario. The last one in 2008. Is there a little glimmer of hope at the end of the tunnel? Yes, there is. The Global Alliance for Development of TB Tuberculosis Drugs, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, many other foundations are providing money, so just pouring it into the development of drugs, and the most promising one appears to be this one called diarylquinolone, which actually acts on a new target, ATP synthase, and in combination with other therapy, it actually looks like it's even better than INH and rifampin, and they're looking at therapeutic combinations that will lead to perhaps treatment durations of 2 to 4 months, which would be way better than 6 to 8, hopefully better tolerated. Thank you. This is just to show you, in Canada, actually in North America, the TB lab up at the Public Health Labs in Toronto is the largest one by volume in North America, and this is what we cook all of our cultures in, these machines. And we have 9 of them, and each one of them holds about 960. So we're on any one time, we have about 8,000 cultures going. So that's just to give you a little bit more in terms of the numbers. Any questions? Okay, sure. Genetic fingerprinting, of course, that's gotten more complex as you go along, but we've been doing that since the 1997. So for about the past 20 years, there's a means of what you see on CSI or whatever, those actual fingerprints. So we just take the DNA, we cut it at certain sites, and it, we run it on a gel, and it gives us a pattern. So we've been doing that for almost all of our TB isolates, but more recently, as David was saying, I've been doing it prospectively on every single one. Because we had a lot of organisms, it was difficult to do everything, but we're doing it prospectively. And the reason we're doing that is because what you use it for is to see if this person's TB isolate is the same as that person's TB isolate, and if it is, the potential that one or the other, depending on the temporal relationship, transmitted it, you can determine how they got their TB and hopefully shut down the transmission pipeline. And we would do that to help the health units, when they're investigating a case, say, oh yeah, okay, that makes sense to us. What we've been doing prospectively is, well, maybe there's clusters out there, clusters two or more of these identical TBs. Are there clusters that aren't recognized? And yes, there are. And what we've been seeing is we've been showing very interesting patterns of transmission within certain groups that were previously unrecognized. And one of those is our socially underhoused and the spread of TB within that group. They have, in fact, their own unique strain that we've identified. And it seems to stay within that group in Toronto, but we've seen little offshoots that have appeared and have moved around southern Ontario and actually reflecting the movement of these people. We're also looking at the lineages that we see. So when you type the strains, you can also kind of tell where did they come from in the world, and it pretty much in Ontario reflects the heterogeneity of our population. And we see clusters of what are called the Beijing strain, which is an East Asian strain in and around the province, and we're also seeing clusters of Manila strain, which is sort of, needless to say, in the Indian Southeast Asian area. And just trying to think of what other... The other thing that we've identified, which has been very interesting, is we're filling in gaps for clusters that were recognized by the health unit earlier, but what they didn't realize is that many of the other ones that we've typed in are now identical. When they go back, they see that temporally over time, in fact, one over the past decade, has shown that this particular strain of TB is being transmitted in a particular social setting, which they didn't actually realize before. And the geospatial aspect of it, we're trying to look at, is there, in TB, a lot of it has to do with who you're with and where you are. It may be within families, but definitely social settings outside, so things called social network analysis, where it looks at spatial analysis of where a patient is, who they hung out with, where they hung out with, and how does that map to the different strains that we're seeing. One geospatial sort of connection, we identified that a patient had a strain of TB that was totally identical to somebody else. It didn't make sense to the health unit, but they were actually co-located in the same apartment building. And so that actually, they went back and looked, and it's very likely that this particular person got the TB from that person who was co-located in that building. Would never have seen it otherwise if we hadn't mapped it together and actually done the genetic typing. Another component of that. So I've been putting this together actually in a GIS system for the health units so that they can get this very complex genetic typing information. So we not only do the actual classic fingerprint, we do digital signatures for the organism. That's looking at other components of the genome. And so putting it all together to make it simpler for the health units and basically showing them that, you know, based on these three methods, which makes it very, very tight, you know, these two isolates are identical, so it tells them that yes, they need to go and investigate further and figure out why those two patients are linked. And so we plot it on a map. They can kind of see where the cases are. They can kind of see which of the where the clusters are, and put that against all the other information that they have that they collect on these patients.
Can you put a figure on how much of the resistance that's transmitting the
In Ontario, I'd say not that much by transmission. That for drug MDR TB, we just don't see a lot of it. We're seeing 10 to 15 cases annually, and those are all usually new cases that aren't linked to a cluster. The mono-resistance, which we see a fair bit of for isoniazid, that may be transmitted, and sometimes we have seen it transmitted, usually within families, because isoniazid mono-resistance is quite common in our in East Asian strains in that. We see it mostly in them. And so that familial transmission pattern does occur. We haven't seen, at not like New York City, we have not seen that we can recognize clusters of transmission of drug resistant isolates.
I recall reading somewhere recently that, well, at least the paper came out of Australia, that something like 95% of the cases that they were analyzing of resistance were a result of transmission, not the spontaneous.
You mean they were primary drug resistant?
From somebody else.
Yeah, and very like, well, and in fact, we would call our cases here primary drug resistance because when they're first diagnosed, they're drug resistant, but they likely didn't get, I was taking it in Ontario, they likely actually got it from where they came from. So yes, I'm sure it's being transmitted around. The issue with drug resistant mutants is their fitness. A lot of lots of research going on there because the sense is, okay, they're not quite as fit. Usually if you have some kind of mutation, deletion, it affects, you know, how the organism metabolizes, and usually it's not in a good way. But they have, there's a lot of work on compensatory evolution, and in some of these populations, their other genes are mutating that are actually helping it overcome this drug-resistant deletion or mutation. So they're actually reasonably fit to transmit, and that's probably what's being seen. I'm sorry, I'm pretty deaf.